pleasant moments in the breeze. Might have an RCE reply to my requests.
Yeah, Amos snorted.
If the RCE bigwig sent a reply seconds after receiving your message, they should be arriving just about now.
I won't let your facts about light delay get in the way of my optimism.
Not much does.
Holden was silent for a long moment. He licked his lips.
If they say no, he said, if they're committed to letting Murtry hold on to her, I'm going to have to make a decision about whether she's more important than keeping this place from devolving into a shooting war.
Yep. I'm pretty sure I know what I'm going to pick, too.
Yep.
There will be people who think I'm very selfish.
True, Amos said. But also, fuck 'em. They're not us.
That us and them thing is the problem at the base of all this, Holden started. But his hand terminal interrupted, a high-priority alarm sounding. It was the alert reserved for crew person in danger. Naomi, he thought. Something happened to Naomi.
Amos took a few steps toward Holden, his brow furrowing and hands clenching into fists. His mind had gone to the same place. If something had actually happened to Naomi, there was no way he'd be able to stop Amos from killing Murtry this time. Probably he wouldn't even try.
Holden here, he said, trying to keep his voice level.
Cap, we got a problem,
Alex replied. His voice was shaky, terrified. Holden had flown with Alex through half a dozen battles. Not even when the missile trails filled the sky around them had he ever heard his pilot panic. Whatever it was bad.
Is she hurt?
What? Who?
You mean Naomi?
Naomi's fine as far as I know, Alex replied.
You're in deep shit, Captain.
Holden looked around. First landing looked quiet. A new shift of belters were boarding the carts that would take them to the mine. A few people walked the streets, going about their business. The two RCE security people on patrol were chatting amiably with a local and sipping some sort of hot drink from a thermos. The only violent thing happening within line of sight was a mimic lizard slowly dragging a stomach-engulfed bird back through its gullet.
Okay, Holden said. Something blew up on the other side of the planet, Alex said, talking fast enough to stumble over his words, most of his drawl disappearing. Absolutely flattened an island chain over there. I mean, it's like someone dropped a rock, kill the dinosaurs kind of thing. Shockwave is heading around the planet right now. You have about 6 hours. Maybe.
Amos had traded his angry face in for one of genuine surprise. It wasn't an expression he wore often, and it made him look vaguely childlike.
6 hours until what, Alex? Holden said. Details, please.
Figure 200-300 kilometer an hour winds, lightning, torrential rains. You're far enough inland to avoid the 3-kilometer-high tsunami.
Basic Wrath of God package, minus drowning, Holden said, reaching for humor to hide his rising fear.
How certain is this?
Captain? I'm watching the other side of the planet rip itself to shreds right now. This isn't a prediction. This is thousands of clicks of planet between you and the apocalypse disappearing fast.
Got some video to send?
Yep, said the pilot. Got fresh underwear for after you wash it?
Send it anyway. I may need it to convince the locals. Holden out.
So, Cap, Amos said, what's the plan?
I haven't got a clue.
Run it again, Murtry said after Holden played the apocalyptic video Alex had shot with the Rocinante's telescopes. Holden, Murtry, and Carol Chiwiwi were in the town hall. Holden's terminal synced up to the big screen hanging on one wall. Holden obliged and played through the recording a second time. Again, the big island disappeared in a flash of light and a column of fire. Again, the other islands vanished under a massive wall of water, and then the spreading clouds of steam and ash. Again, the shock wave raced away from the center of the explosion, dragging massive waves behind it. As the video played, Murtry talked quietly on his hand terminal with someone. Carol shook her head gently, as though it were possible to deny the evidence playing on screen. The video ended, and Murtry said, "This is matching our data. The geoengineering group thinks there was some kind of fission reaction down near the bottom of the ocean." Holden prickled at the implication he might be lying about something so serious, but held his tongue. "Like a bomb?" Carol Chiwiwi said. "Or an alien power plant failing out," Murtry said. "Can't really speculate." "How quickly can we evacuate?" Carol said, her voice surprisingly firm for a person who just looked Armageddon in the eye. "That's what we're here to talk about," Holden said. "What's our best plan for protecting the colony? Evacuation is one option, but we're down to a little over 5 hours now." "Evacuation won't work," Murtry said. "At least using our shuttle. The window's too tight. We'd be taking off in the face of that shockwave with turbulence and atmospheric ionization doing its best to knock us out of the sky. Better to survive down here and still have a shuttle available afterward for relief." Holden frowned and nodded. "I hate to admit it, but I agree. Alex says he can't put the Rosie down and get it back off the ground before the blast. And if we do try to evacuate, we'll probably have riots on our hands. How do you tell someone that their kid doesn't get to leave on the shuttle?" "Riots won't be a problem," Murtry said. The calm of his voice was chilling. "How do we protect everyone?" "The entire colony," Holden said, again choosing to ignore the provocation. "There's mines," Amos said. He hovered over Holden like an anxious parent. He started doing that whenever Murtry was around. "No," Carol shook her head. "It's low ground. It'll flood if we get too much rain." "I think we should count on anything that can go wrong doing so," Holden agreed. "So no pits and caves that can fill up with water. I'm thinking the ruins." Murtry leaned back in his chair, frowning. "What makes you think those'll hold up to 300 kilometer an hour winds?" "Honestly? I have no good reason to believe that," Holden said. "But they've been there a very long time. That's what I've got. Hope that if they made it this far, they can make it through what's coming." "Better than those huts you guys are living in," Amos added with a beefy shrug. "I can kick down any building in this town in 10 minutes. Murtry leaned back even farther in his chair, staring up at the ceiling and making clicking noises with his tongue. After a few seconds, he said, "Okay, that's as good a plan as any I have. We just need to outlive that initial shockwave. What comes after will be bad, but we'll be able to take any survivors off through it. So, let's play it your way. I'll get my people moving. Better get the word out." "Carol, find as many people as you can to spread the news," Holden said. "Make sure everyone brings as much food and water as they can reasonably carry, but nothing else. The planet's on fire. Can't stop to save mementos." "I'll give her a hand," Amos said. "We're on the clock," Holden reminded them, punching an alert into his hand terminal as he said it. "I want to see all of you inside the structure in 4 hours, not a minute later." "We'll try," Carol said. It took longer to move the colonists than Holden had hoped. Each person told had to express shock and disbelief. Then they had to have a conversation about their surprise. Then they had to have a conversation about what items they'd bring with them. Some argued about bringing personal items, each one sure that their particular case was unique. Every time Holden heard it happen, he wanted to start shouting. It was the blue sky and gentle breeze. The disaster just wasn't real to them. Not when they could look out across the sky and see nothing but wisps of cloud. They were playing along because Holden and Carol and Murtry were in charge, and you did what the people in charge asked you to do unless there was a compelling reason not to. But Holden could see the disbelief in their eyes, hear it in every silly delay and argument. Across the street, a man was clutching a bundle of clothing under one arm while he dragged a large plastic container of water behind him. Amos walked over and traded a few smiling words with the man. The man vigorously shook his head and tried to walk off. Amos grabbed the bundle of clothes out of his hands and threw them on top of a nearby hut, then picked up the water and shoved it into the man's arms. The man started to argue, but Amos stared him down with a vague smile, and eventually the other man turned and left, trudging after the others headed to the alien ruins. "Captain?" a tentative voice said to his back. He turned around to find Elvi Okoye smiling up at him, a large sack thrown over one shoulder. "Hello," he said. "What have you got there?" "It's blankets. Fayez and Sudyam and I are bringing all the blankets we had at the compound. The temperature's sure to drop significantly once the debris cloud covers us. The nights will get cold."
"Good thinking. We should probably tell some more people to bring blankets."
"So," she added, still with her unsure half-smile, "I wanted to ask for some help for the chemical sciences group."
"Help?"
"The chemical analysis deck is pretty heavy, and they're having trouble moving it. One or two more people would make the job a lot easier."
Holden laughed in disbelief. "We won't be doing science up there, Elvi. Tell them to ditch it and carry water or food instead."
"It makes water," she said.
"They can carry..." "It makes what?"
"It can sterilize and distill water," she said, nodding as if by doing so she could make him agree faster. "We might need it, for when, you know, the bottles run out."
"Yes," he said, feeling like an idiot.
"Yes," she agreed, smiling helpfully.
"Amos," he yelled, "find someone to help you, then follow her. There's a big piece of equipment they need help moving."
"Equipment?"
Amos frowned. "Wouldn't food or water be—"
"It makes water," Holden and Elvi said at the same time.
"Roger," Amos said and left in a hurry.
Holden noticed that a subtle darkening of the sky had begun. The sun was still high. It was barely past midday and into the early afternoon, but the sunlight was shifting toward red, and the world was darkening along with it, as though a beautiful sunset were starting about 5 hours early. Something about the change sent a shiver up his spine.
"Get up there," Holden said, giving Elvi a gentle push toward the alien towers. "Go, now. Tell your people to hurry."
To her credit, she didn't argue, just took off at a dead run back toward the RCE science compound. All around him, the colonists were moving faster, arguing less, and casting the occasional frightened glance at the sky. Holden hadn't been inside the alien structure since he'd looked it over as a crime scene. It had the same eerie and inhuman aesthetic sense he'd seen before, first on Eros after the infection, and later on the ring station at the heart of the gate network. Curves and angles that were subtly wrong and yet weirdly beautiful at the same time. He tried to imagine what use the protomolecule masters had made of the buildings, and failed. He couldn't picture them housing machines like a factory, nor could he picture them as dwellings, scattered with furniture and personal items. It was as if, standing empty as they were, they still fulfilled whatever alien function they'd always been meant to serve. It was also where Baja Merton and the others had hidden their explosives, where they'd killed the security team. The bloodiest crimes that had been committed on the planet had all been centered right here, where they were all going now.
"Give me another recount," Carol Chiwiwi said to her aides. "Who are we missing? Find out who we're missing."
She'd been doing head counts of the colonists ever since she'd arrived, almost the last person in. They kept coming up with new numbers over and over as stragglers drifted in and people milled around. It was an impossible task, but Holden respected her commitment to ensuring they left no one behind. The RCE science team huddled together in one rounded corner of the building's large central room, Elvi among them. Several scientists were fiddling with a large machine, getting it ready to purify large quantities of water, Holden hoped. Lucia drifted across the room to exchange a few words with Elvi, her son Jacek in tow. Holden breathed a sigh of relief they'd both made it. Baggio would be up on the Rosinante going out of his mind with worry, and Holden was happy he'd be able to report that they were as safe as he could make them.
"Hey, Cap," Amos said, coming out of a side room with several colonists trailing. "We got a problem."
"Another one? Worse than the cataclysmic storm heading our way?"
"Related, I'd guess you'd say," Amos replied. "We've been going through the headcounts, and it looks like the Dahlke family is missing."
"We're sure about that?"
"Pretty," Amos said with a shrug.
Carol saw them talking and made her way through the crowded room toward them.
100% sure, she said. "Clay Dahlke was in town picking up supplies when we warned him. He headed out to get his wife and daughter. They've got the house farthest outside of town. I should have sent someone along, but I was stupid."
"You had plenty to do," Holden reassured her.
"How far from here is the Dahlke place?"
3 clicks, Amos said. "I'm about to head out with these guys and see if we can find them."
"Wait a minute," Holden said. "I'm not sure you can make a 6-kilometer round trip with the time we have left, let alone look for someone."
"Not leaving that little girl out there, Chief," Amos said.
He kept his voice carefully neutral, but Holden could hear the barest presentiment of a threat hiding in it.
"All right," Holden said, giving in. "But let me call up to the Rosie and get an update. At least let me do that."
"Sure,"
Amos said agreeably.
"Someone's looking for a poncho for the kid right now, anyway."
Holden headed out of the main room and through the confusion of smaller chambers around it, trying to find the entrance. The alien building was a maze of connecting passages and rooms. As he walked, he pulled out his hand terminal.
"Alex, this is Holden. You listening?"
The sound coming out of the terminal was filled with static from the atmosphere's heavy ionization, but Holden could still hear Alex when he said,
"Alex here, what's the word?"
"Give me an update. How close are we?"
"Oh, boss, you just need to look west."
The fear in Alex's voice was audible even over the heavy static. Holden stepped out of the alien tower's main entrance and looked toward the slowly setting sun. A curtain of black covered the horizon as far as the eye could see. It was moving so quickly that even from dozens of kilometers away it appeared to hurtle toward him. A black, roiling cliff shot through with lightning. The ground beneath his feet trembled and shook, and Holden remembered that sound moved more quickly through a solid than through the air. The vibration he felt now was the sound of all that fury coming through the earth like an early warning. Even as he thought it, a rising roar started in the west.
"What's it look like?"
Amos had come into the antechamber and was pulling a light backpack on. His colonist friends stood behind him, their faces a mixture of hope and fear.
"It's too late, big man," Holden said, looking west and shaking his head. "It's way too late."
He wasn't sure, as he said it, if he meant for the Dahlkes or for all of them. Chapter 30. Elvie. The storm front came, seeming slow at first, a tall, purple-black churn higher than skyscrapers, with only the slightest stirrings in the warm air to show that it was real. And then, between one breath and the next, hit with the violence of a blow. Air and water and mud jetted through the windows, archways, and holes in the ruin like the stream from a fire hose. It did not simply roar. It deafened. Elvie curled with her back against the wall of the ruin, her arms wrapped around her knees, and endured. The walls shuddered against her spine, vibrating with the hurricane gusts. Across from her, Michaela had her hands over her ears, her mouth open in a shriek that Elvie couldn't hear. She had thought the rain would be cold, but it wasn't. The slurry that soaked up on the ruin's floor was warm and salty, and somehow that was worse. She laced her fingers together, squeezing until her knuckles ached.
The mud-thick water filled the air until the spray made it hard to breathe. Someone lurched through the archway to her left, but she could no more make out who than stop the catastrophe by willing it. She felt certain that the ruins would fail, the more than ancient walls snap apart, and she and all the rest of them would be thrown into the storm, crushed or drowned, or both. All she could think of was being in the heavy shuttle, the confusion and the panic when it was going down, the trauma of the impact. This felt the same, but it went on and on and on until she found herself almost missing the sudden impact of the crash. That, at least, had ended. She knew that it was daytime, but the only lights were the cold white of the emergency lights and the near constant barrage of lightning that caught people's faces like a strobe. A young man, his face set and stony like an image of suffering and endurance, a child no more than 8 years old, his head buried in his mother's shoulder. Wei and Mertry in uniform, standing as close as lovers and shouting into each other's ears in the effort to be heard, their faces flushed red. The vast shifts of barometric pressure were invisible, but she felt them in the sense of overwhelming illness, of wrongness, that washed through her body. She couldn't tell if the shaking came from the walls of the storm-battered ruins, more little earthquakes, or her own overloaded nervous system. At some point, her perception of time changed. She couldn't say if the storm had been hours or days or minutes. It was like the half-awareness of trauma, the doomed patience of being assaulted and knowing the only thing that would end it was the mercy of the attacker. Now and then, she would feel herself rising to some fuller consciousness and will herself back into the stupor. Shock. Maybe she was going into shock. Her awareness seemed to blink in and out. She was curled against Faez, both her hands squeezing at his elbow, and didn't remember how she'd gotten there. The dark slurry of mud was ankle high all through the ruins, brown and green. She was covered in it. They were all covered in it. When this is over, I'm going back to my hut, take a long bath, and sleep for a week, she thought. She knew it was ridiculous. Her hut would no more have withstood this than a match could stay lit underwater. But she still thought it, and some part of her believed it was true. A blinding bright flash and crackling detonation came almost simultaneously. She gritted her teeth, closed her eyes, and endured. The first change she noticed was a baby screaming. It was an exhausted sound. She shifted, her shirt and pants soaked and cold and adhering to her skin with the muck. She craned her neck, trying to find where the grating noise was coming from. She felt the thought shifting at the base of her skull before she knew what it was, a surreal lag between the realization and being conscious of it. She could hear a baby crying. She could hear something, anything that wasn't the malice and venom of the storm. She tried to stand up, and her legs buckled under her. Kneeling in the muck, she gathered herself, squared her shoulders, and tried again. The rain slanted in through the windows of the ruin, but only at about 20 degrees. It still fell in buckets out of a black sky. The wind gusted and pushed and howled. In any other context, it would have been the teeth of a gale. Here and now, it meant the worst was over. Dr. Okoye? Mertry's face was lit from below. The emergency lantern hung over his shoulder. His expression was the same polite smile over sober, focused attention. Her battered mind wondered whether there was anything that could shake the man's soul, and thought perhaps there wasn't. She wanted to be reassured by his predictability, but her body wasn't able to feel comfort. Not now.
Are you all right, doctor?
He said, his hand on her shoulder. She nodded, and when he started to step away, she clutched at him. How long? The front hit a little over 16 hours ago, he said.
Thank you, she said, and turned back to the window and the rain.
The lightning still played among the clouds and lanced down to the ground, but not so often now. The flashes showed her a transformed landscape. Rivers flowed, where yesterday had been desert hardpan. The flowers, or what she thought of as flowers, were churned into nothing. Not even sticks remained. She couldn't imagine how the mimic lizards could have survived, or the bird-like animals she'd thought of as rock sparrows. She'd meant to go to the wash east of First Landing and collect samples of the pink lichen that clung in the shadows there. She wouldn't get to now. The sense of loss was like a weight in her throat. She had glimpsed an ecosystem unlike anything anyone had ever seen before, a web of life that had grown up apart from anything she had known. She and her work groups had been the only people ever to walk in that garden. And now, it was gone. The usual state of nature is recovering from the last disaster, she said. It was a truism of ecological biologists, and she said it the way a religious person might pray. To make sense of what she saw, to comfort herself, to give the world some sense of purpose or meaning. Species rose in an environment, and that environment changed. It was the nature of the universe, as true here as it had been on Earth. She wept quietly, her tears indistinguishable from the rain.
Well, there's something I wasn't expecting, Holden said.
She turned to look at him. The dimness of the ruins rendered him in monochrome. He was a sepia print of James Holden. His hair was plastered back, clinging to his head and the nape of his neck. Mud streaked his shirt. She was too tired to dissemble. She took his hand in hers and followed his gaze toward the back of the ruins. His hand was solid and warm in hers, and if there was some stiffness and hesitation in it, at least he didn't flinch away. Carol Chiwiwi and four other squatters were baling the storm muck out the window with stiff plastic utility panels, streaks of green-brown staining the pale gray. Behind them, 20 or 30 of the squatters from First Landing were clumped in groups, huddled together under blankets. RCE security moved among them with bottles of water and foil-packed emergency rations. Faez and Lucia were standing together, talking animatedly. Elvi couldn't make out the words.
I don't see it, she said. What weren't you expecting?
He squeezed her fingers and let go of her hand. Her palm felt colder without his in it.
Your security people helping the Belters, he said. I guess nothing brings people together like a disaster.
That's not true, Elvi said. We would always have helped. We came out here planning to help. I don't know why everyone thinks that we're so awful. We didn't do anything wrong.
Her voice cracked on the last word, and she started weeping in earnest. She felt oddly distanced from her grief, as if she were watching it from the outside, and then Holden put his hand on her shoulder, and she felt the pain. For a time, it washed her away, flooded her. 3 lightning strikes came close by, loud and bright and sudden, the thunder from them rolling away in the distance.
I'm sorry, she said, when she could say anything. There's just been so much.
No, I should apologize, Holden said. I didn't mean to make you feel worse, it's just...
I understand, she said, reaching for his hand again.
Let him laugh at her. Let him turn her away. She didn't care now. She just wanted to be touched, to be held.
Hey, Cap, Amos said, looming up out of the darkness. He had a clear plastic poncho over his shoulders, the hood straining to fit the thick neck. You gonna be all right for a while?
Holden stepped back, retreating from her. She felt a brief, irrational flash of rage toward the big man for intruding. She bit her lip and scowled up at him. If he noticed, he gave no sign.
I don't actually know how to answer that question,
Holden said.
I don't see any reason I'd die right away. It's about the best I've got.
Beats the alternative, anyway, Amos said.
So, that Dalkey family that didn't make it here before the shit hit the fan?
Yeah, some of us are gonna go have a look-see.
Holden scowled.
You sure that's a good idea?
It's still pretty bad out there.
And this is more water than I'm guessing this place has ever seen.
There's been a lot of flooding, and there's no good way to get help out if something goes south.
They had a little girl, Amos said.
The two men exchanged a long look that seemed to carry the weight of some earlier conversation. Elvie felt like a stranger watching two family members communicate in the half-code of long familiarity.
Be careful, Holden replied after a long moment.
That ship may have sailed, but I'll do what I can.
Wei walked toward them. She'd taken off her armor, but she still had an automatic rifle strapped to her back. She nodded at Amos.
I've got a couple more who want to tag along.
Don't matter to me if it don't matter to you, Amos said.
Wei nodded. There was a darkness in her eyes that seemed to echo Amos's.
Elvie looked over.
A half dozen other people were struggling into the same kind of poncho Amos wore. In the dimness and the wreckage, it was hard to tell which of them were squatters and which were RCE. Even belters and earthers were hard to differentiate now.
Elvie didn't know if that was an artifact of the darkness, or if some deeper part of her brain was changing her perceptions, making anything human into something like her. Minds could be tricky that way.
Among them, she caught a glimpse of Faez, and her mouth went coppery with sudden fear.
Wait, she said, hopping across the space.
Faez, wait, what are you doing?
Helping out, he said. Also getting out of this sardine can. I've gotten used to having a couple feet of social distance. Just being around all these people stresses me out.
You can't, it's dangerous out there.
I know.
You stay here,
she said, grabbing at his poncho and tugging it up, trying to get it back over his head.
I can go.
Elvie, he said.
Elvie, stop it!
She had a double handful of plastic sheeting in her fingers. It was already wet.
Let them go, she said. They're professionals. They can take care of this. We, people like us,
we're past us and them at this point. We're just people in a bad place, Faez said, and then a moment later. You know what I am, Elvie.
No. No, you're a good man, Faez.
He tilted his head. I meant that I'm a geologist. It's not like they need me to talk about plate tectonics. What were you thinking?
I just...
Come on, Professor, Wei said, tapping Faez on the arm. Time to go for a walk.
How can I refuse? Faez said, gently taking the plastic sheeting out of Elvie's hands.
She stood watching as six of them walked together toward the entrance. Amos, Wei, Faez, and three of the squatters. No, two squatters and Sudyam. One-use chemical lanterns glowing in their hands. They walked out into the gale. She stood at the window, ignoring the rain that soaked her. Amos and Wei took the lead, their heads down, their ponchos blowing out behind them. The others followed close behind, clustered like ducklings. The night around them was black and violent, and they moved into the downpour, growing fainter with every minute until she couldn't make them out at all. She stood there a while longer, her mind empty and exhausted. She found Lucia and Jacek in one of the larger chambers. Two belters were struggling to place a wide plastic panel over one of the windows to block the rain now that the wind wasn't so violent that it would simply shatter. A half dozen others were scraping out the muck. They'd already done so much work, Elvie could see pale strips of the ground. Everywhere, people were sleeping, curled into and against each other. The sound of the storm was still enough to drown out their moans. Or most of them. Lucia looked up at her. The woman seemed to have aged a decade, but she managed to smile. Elvie sat down beside her. They were both covered in salt mud, and the muck was starting to reek a little. Putrescence, or something like it. All the small life forms living in the planet's great ocean had been broken and thrown to the sky, starting to decay. It broke her heart to think of the scale of the death that surrounded them, so she didn't.
"Can I help you?" Lucius said.
"I came to ask the same thing," Elvie said.
"Tell me what I can do."
The long, terrible night went on, the rain slackening only slightly. No light came to the clouds. No rainbows promised that the disaster was ended. Elvie moved from one group to another, talking and checking. Some were the squatters, some were RCE. All had the same stunned expressions, the same sense of amazement that they were still alive. The scent of the muck was getting richer and more pungent as whatever organic structures it had held broke down. Elvie hated to imagine how the world would stink when the last of the rains fell and the sun came back to warm the landscape. That was a problem for another time. She didn't notice it when she fell asleep. She'd been at the window, looking out in hopes of catching a glimpse of the search party's return. She remembered very clearly hearing Holden's voice behind her and a woman replying to him. She'd meant to turn back, find him, ask if she could help, if she could do something to stay in motion, to keep from thinking or feeling for another hour more. But instead, she woke up. For a moment, she didn't know where she was. Her exhaustion-drunk mind tried to make the close quarters into her cabin on the Israel, as if she were still on the journey out to New Terra. As if none of this had ever happened. Then, the present reasserted itself. She was in the corner of a smaller chamber. Eight other people were stretched out in the damp ground around her, heads pillowed by their arms. Someone was snoring, and a body was pressed up against hers. Lightning stuttered in the distance, and she saw the body beside hers was Faez. The thunder came a long time later, and softly. Then, there was only the patter of rain. She touched his shoulder, shaking him gently. He groaned and shifted, the poncho still on him, crackling with the motion.
"Well, good morning, Dr. Okoye," he said. "Imagine meeting you here."
"Is it?
Is it what?
A good morning?"
He sighed in the dark.
"Honestly, I don't even think it's morning."
"Did you find them?"
"We didn't find anything."
"I'm sorry."
"I mean, we didn't find anything at all. The huts are gone. First landing's gone. The mine pit's gone, or else the landmarks are so different we couldn't find it. The roads are gone."
"Oh.
You know those pictures you see of a natural disaster where there's nothing but mud and rubble? Imagine that. Without the rubble."
Elvie lay back down.
"I'm sorry."
"If we only lose them, it'll be a miracle. We managed to get a signal through to the Israel. The atmospheric data make it look like we'll be going without a sunrise for a good long time. No one said the words nuclear winter, but I think it's safe to say things aren't going to be business as usual around here for a nice long while. We've got the battery power we carried in with us, but no hydroponics. Only as much fresh water as the chemistry deck will pump out. I was hoping that some of the storage buildings might have made it. They were pretty well built, some of them.
Still, maybe some good can come out of it."
"I admire your psychotic optimism."
"I'm serious. I mean, look at us all. You went out with Amos and Wei and the locals. We're all here together, working together. We're taking care of each other. Maybe that is what it takes to resolve all the violence. There were three sides before. There's only one side now."
Faez sighed.
"It's true. Nothing points out shared humanity like a natural disaster, or a disaster, anyway. Nothing on this mudball of a planet's even remotely natural, if you ask me."
"So that's a good thing," she said.
"It is," Faez agreed, and then a moment later,
I give it 5 days.
Chapter 31. Holden. Holden had witnessed the aftermath of a tornado as a child. They were rare in the Montana flatlands where he'd grown up, but not entirely unheard of. One had touched down on a commercial complex a few miles from his family's farm, and the local citizens had gathered to help with the cleanup. His mother, Tamara, had taken him along. The tornado had hit a farmer's market at the center of the complex, while totally avoiding the feed store and fuel station on either side of it. The market had been flattened as if by a giant's fist, the roof lying flat on the ground with the walls splayed out around it. The contents of the store had been scattered in a giant pinwheel that extended for hundreds of meters around the impact point. It was young James Holden's first experience with nature's fury unleashed, and for years afterward, he'd had nightmares about tornadoes destroying his home. This was worse. Holden stood in what his hand terminal told him had been the center of First Landing, the constant rain sheeting off his poncho, and turned in a slow circle. All around, there was nothing but thick mud, occasionally cut by a rivulet of water. There were no flattened buildings, no wreckage strewn across the ground. With the fury and duration of the winds, it was entirely possible that the detritus of First Landing was hundreds or even thousands of kilometers away. The colonists would never rebuild. There was nothing to rebuild. A ripple of lights danced through the heavy cloud cover overhead, and a second later the booming of the thunder, like a barrage of cannon fire. The rain intensified, reducing visibility to a few dozen meters and swelling the little streams cutting gullies across the muddy ground.
"I'd say what a mess, but it's actually kind of the opposite of that," Amos said. "Never seen anything like this, Cap."
"What if it happens again?" Holden said, shuddering either at that thought or at the cold rainwater trickling down his back.
"Think they have more than one of whatever blew up? Anyone know what the first one was yet?"
"Nope,"
Amos admitted with a sigh.
"Big fusion reactor, maybe. Alex sent an update. Said it tossed a lot of radiation up around the initial blast.
Some of that will be coming down in the rain."
"Some."
The mud at Amos's feet moved, and a small, slug-like creature pushed its way up out of the ground, desperately trying to get its head above water. Amos casually kicked it into one of the nearby streams where the current whisked it away.
"I'm running low on my cancer meds," Holden said. "Radioactive rain ain't gonna help with that." "Was my thought. Bad for the colonists, too."
"Do we have a plan?"
Amos asked. His tone suggested he didn't expect an answer.
"Get off this hell planet before the next catastrophe."
"A fucking men," Amos replied.
They walked back toward the alien towers, trudging through the thick mud and occasionally having to leap across a newly formed arroyo filled with fast-moving water. The ground was covered with small holes where brightly colored worm slugs had pushed their way to the surface, and shiny trails of slime radiated in all directions, showing their recent passage.
"Never seen these before," Amos said, pointing at another of the creatures slowly making its way across the wet ground.
They weren't much bigger than Holden's thumb and eyeless.
"Forced up by the rain. This was pretty arid land before. There's a lot of subterranean life drowning right now, I'd bet. At least these guys have a way to get out of it."
"Yeah," Amos said, frowning down at one. "But, you know, gross. One of those things climbs into my sleeping bag, I'm gonna be pissed. Big baby."
As if in response to Amos's worries, the ground shifted, and dozens more of the slugs pushed their way up. Wrinkling his nose in disgust, Amos picked his way through them, trying not to get their slime on his boots. The trails they left were quickly washed away by the rain. Holden's hand terminal buzzed at them, and he pulled it out to find that a message had been downloaded.
The terminal had been trying to connect to the Rosie for hours. There must have finally been a break in the storm long enough for it to send and receive updates. He tried to open a channel to Alex, but got only static. Whenever his window had happened, he'd missed it. But the fact that there were occasional breaks in the atmospheric clutter was a hopeful sign that they'd get comms back soon. In the meantime, he could keep sending messages and hoping they'd slip through the static a bit at a time. The update waiting for him was a voice message. He plugged the bud into his ear and hit play. "This is a message for Captain James Holden from Arturo Ramsey, lead counsel for Royal Charter Energy." Holden had sent dozens of requests to the various senior vice presidents and board members of RCE for Naomi to be released. Getting a reply back from the company's top lawyer was not a good sign. "Captain Holden," the message continued, "Royal Charter Energy takes your request for the release of Naomi Nagata from detention on the Edward Israel very seriously. However, the legal landscape we're navigating with this situation is murky at best." "It's not murky. Give me my damn XO back, you smug bastards," Holden muttered angrily. At Amos's questioning look, he shook his head and continued the recording. "Pending further investigation, we're afraid we're going to have to follow the advice of the security team on site and hold Naomi Nagata in protective custody. We hope you understand the delicate..." Holden turned off the recording in disgust. Amos raised an eyebrow. "That's the legal wonk at RCE telling me they plan to keep holding Naomi," Holden said. "Following the advice of the security team on site." "Murtry," Amos grunted. "Who else?" "Sort of wondering why you haven't let me off the leash on that, Cap," Amos said. "Because before this," Holden waved an arm at the mud and rain and worms around them, "we had a job to do that would not have been aided by murdering the RCE security chief. Would have loved to give it a try, though. You know, just to see." "Well, my friend, you might still get your shot," Holden said, "because I'm about to order him to do something he really isn't going to want to do." "Oh," Amos said with a smile. "Goody." When they returned to the ruins, the camp was in chaos. People were frantically sweeping something out of the tower entrance using blankets and sticks and other makeshift implements. An agonized howl echoed out of the structure, like someone in terrible pain. Dr. Okoye spotted them from the tower opening and ran to meet them. "Captain, we have a serious problem." Before he could reply, she kicked one of the worms away from his feet with a squeal. "Look out!" Holden had watched her capture and sacrifice a number of the local fauna during their association. She'd never struck him as squeamish. He couldn't picture a few slimy slug analogs being the thing that broke her. "What's going on?" he asked when she'd finished kicking slugs away from him. "A man died," she said. "The one who was married to the man and woman who took care of the carts. The taller one. Beth is her name, I think. The wife's name. That's her crying inside." "And that relates to the worms, how?" "That slime they secrete is a neurotoxin," Elvie replied, wide-eyed. "He touched it, and it was almost instant paralysis. Full respiratory failure. One of the worms was climbing up a wall near their sleeping area, and he grabbed it to throw outside. By the time we realized what was happening, he was dead." "Jesus," Amos said, staring down at the worms surrounding them, something like respect mixed in with his disgust. "Some kind of defense toxin?" Holden asked. "I don't know," Elvie replied. "It might just be slime to aid in locomotion like a terrestrial slug. It might not be toxic to the other life forms on New Terra. We've never even seen them before. How can we know anything? If I had my collection equipment, I could send the data back to Luna, if I could send the message back to Luna, but..." Elvie's voice was rising as she spoke. When she ended, she was almost in tears. "You're right," Holden said. "It was a stupid question, and it doesn't matter anyway." "Why doesn't it..." Elvie started, but Holden pushed past her. "Where's Murtry?" he asked. "Inside, organizing the people to find and remove all the slugs from the structure." "Come on, Amos," Holden said. "Let's change his priorities.
Inside, the fear was so pronounced, it was almost an odor. Half of the colonists were in almost frantic activity, building slug-sweeping implements and clearing the structure. The other half sat on the floor, many wrapped tight in blankets, empty expressions on their faces. The human mind could only take so much threat. Everyone had a different limit. And he couldn't really blame the people who had been broken by the last 30 hours. It was actually sort of amazing that it hadn't happened to all of them. He was, however, unsurprised to see Baj's wife and son busily at work with the chemical sciences team. "Dr. Merton," he greeted her with an apologetic smile. "Captain," she replied. Her returning smile was thin and very tired. As the colony's only doctor, she'd had a very long day. "I've heard about the death," he started, but she cut him off with a sharp nod and a gesture toward the chemical analysis deck. "We're analyzing the toxin right now," she said. "It's unlikely we'll be able to make a counteragent with the tools available, but we're going to try." "I appreciate the effort," Holden said, "but I'm hoping to make it unnecessary." "Are we being forced to leave?" she said, a look of sad resignation replacing her wan smile. "After all this, maybe not forever," Holden said, putting his hands on her shoulders. She felt very thin. She nodded slowly, looking around them at the dirty, frightened people filling the room. "I can't argue. There's nothing left to fight over." "Oh," Holden thought, "some people can always find a reason to fight. Speaking of which, I need to find Murtry." Lucia gestured at the opening behind her, and Holden left with one last squeeze of her shoulders and what he hoped was an encouraging smile. In the next room, Murtry was down on his haunches looking at something on the floor. Wei stood behind him, nose wrinkled in disgust and a rifle in her hands. "Wei?" Amos said with a nod. "Amos?" the security officer replied with a grin. Holden wondered what was going on there. They couldn't have a thing, could they? When would they have found time to have a thing? But they definitely acted like they were sharing a private joke.
"Captain Holden," Murtry said, standing up, not giving him more time to think about possible Amos and Wei dalliances. On the floor behind the RCE security chief was a clear plastic bowl inverted over one of the slugs. The creature was nuzzling its prison with its pointed, eyeless face.
"Made a friend," Holden said, pointing at the slug.
"They say it's a good idea to know your enemy," Murtry replied.
"They say a lot of stuff."
"Yes, yes they do. How did the recon go?"
"About how you'd expect," Holden said. "Initial reports are correct. There isn't a single standing structure. Not even the remains of one."
"All the colony supplies are lost?"
"We can make potables out of groundwater until the chem lab runs out of supplies. But what's raining out of the sky is radioactive and probably has things living in it."
"All right," Murtry said, scratching his ear with one thick fingernail. "Can we agree at present the insurgent colony might not be viable?"
"You don't have to sound happy about it."
"I'm going to have some relief flown down as soon as comms clears up. RCE is happy to share these needed supplies with the refugees."
"Very magnanimous," Holden said. "But RCE is going to do me a bigger favor."
"Oh?" Murtry said, his face shifting into a smile. "We are?"
"Yeah. Go ahead and bring the supply shuttle down. Evacuation is going to take some time, and we'll want plenty of medicine, food, and shelter to keep these people healthy until everyone is off-world."
"Off-world? Sounds like you're doing us a favor there, Captain."
"I'm not done," Holden said, and took a step forward, deliberately moving into Murtry's space. The security man stiffened, but didn't step back.
"When the shuttle leaves, it's going to take some of the colonists with it. The sick and vulnerable first. And as soon as your people can de-weaponize the second shuttle, it'll start making runs too. I'm giving the same orders to the Barbapicola and the Rocinante."
We're leaving this planet. And if I can't stick everyone on the Rossi and the Barb, the Edward Israel will be taking the rest.
Murtry's smile cooled.
Is that right?
It is.
I fail to see why the ship that brought the squatters here can't also take them away, Murtry said.
One, it no longer has the room, Holden started.
Then they should dump the ore they illegally stole from this world, Murtry said.
And two, he continued as if he hadn't interrupted, she's down to the last of her supplies. I won't stick hundreds of people on that ship that may not make it back to Medina. I doubt it's RCE policy to ignore a humanitarian crisis. And even if it is, it's sure as hell going to make for terrible press.
Murtry took an answering step toward Holden, crossing his arms and shifting his smile into an equally meaningless frown.
Plan B is that I have Amos kill you right now and just take what I want when the shuttle lands, Holden thought, but worked to keep it off his face. Almost as if he could sense the thought, Amos shuffled forward and put one hand on the butt of his pistol. Wei shifted to his right, still gripping her rifle.
We are so close, Holden thought, to all of this going completely off the rails. But he couldn't back down. Not with a couple hundred people living or dying on the outcome of the confrontation.
Wei cleared her throat. Amos grinned back at her.
Murtry cocked his head to one side, his frown deepening.
Here we go, Holden thought, and suppressed the urge to swallow a mouth suddenly full of saliva.
Of course, Murtry said. We'd be happy to assist.
Ah, Holden replied.
You're right. We can't leave them here, Murtry continued. And there isn't room for them anywhere else. I'll let the Israel know they're taking on passengers as soon as we get comms up.
That would be great, Holden said.
Thank you.
Dr. Okoya, Murtry said.
Holden turned to find the diminutive scientist had come in, her usual tentative smile on her face.
Sorry to interrupt, she said, but we've gotten the radio back up. We're on with the Israel right now. You said to tell you as soon as we got through.
Thank you, Murtry said, and started to follow her out of the room.
He paused, as though something had suddenly occurred to him, and turned to Holden.
You know, we're only in this situation because these people came down and built a shantytown. We brought much better structures with us on the heavy shuttle. Much of this could have been avoided.
Holden started to reply, but Elvie said,
Oh no, I'm unhappy about the loss of the dome and the permanent structures too, but we clocked gusts of 370 kilometers an hour out there. Nothing we set up would have withstood that.
Thank you, Dr. Okoya, Murtry said with a tight smile, for correcting me. Let's go call the ship, shall we?
Elvie blinked in puzzlement as Murtry left.
Is he mad at me?
Sweetie, Amos said, clapping her on the back. That just means you're not an asshole.
Chapter 32. Havelock. After they'd lost radio contact with Murtry, Havelock had tried to sleep. He should have slept. There was nothing he could do. Not yet, anyway. Not until it was over. He floated in his couch, the straps keeping him centered over the gel, and willed his consciousness to fade. His mind wouldn't rest. Were they still alive down there? What if the explosion was just the first of several? What if the planet detonated and took out the Israel? Should he have Marwick pull the ship into a higher orbit? Or even away from the planet entirely? And if the Barbapicola tried to do the same, then what? He wasn't supposed to let them break orbit with a full load of RCE's lithium ore. He closed his eyes again, but they opened as soon as he stopped consciously willing them shut. After 3 hours, he gave up, took off his straps, and went to the gym instead. His float atrophied muscles complained with every set, and he put the feed of the planet below on the screen.
The contours of New Terra were gone.